Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Welcome to this episode of Tea with Twiggy. It's great to have you here. This is a podcast where I catch up with friends and people that I find fascinating. I check that they're doing okay and ask for tips to help us stay at home more comfortable. This week's guest is one of the great male vocalists, songwriters and performers of his generation. We've never met, but I'm a huge fan, so I'm very excited to be talking to Rufus Wainwright. Well, I can't believe I'm sitting here talking to Rufus Wainwright. This is so exciting.
Oh, well, the same for me.
Oh, lovely. Before we start our little chat over a cup of tea, do you drink tea?
You know, I'm more of a coffee guy, though in the afternoon, I enjoy a strong cup of builder's tea.
Oh, you like your builder's tea? Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
I've got lemon and ginger today, but I like proper tea with milk. Yeah. Do you have it English style with milk?
Yeah, you know, I have it with milk. I know that you're not supposed to, if you're English, you're not really supposed to put sugar in your tea. Is that true?
Well, I do honey, but a lot of real tea drinkers frown at that.
No, because my mother's boyfriend for about 10, 15 years, he was English, very English.
And oh, really?
He frowned upon the sugar in the tea thing.
That's so funny. So. I wonder why. Maybe he thought it took away the flavour.
Yeah, I don't know.
Somebody told me that last week. They said that actually they frown of milk going in proper tea because it takes away the flavour of the tea. But
good Lord.
I don't know.
The other tea thing is that my husband, who's German, he loves Earl Grey tea.
Yeah.
And English people don't really like Earl Grey tea.
Well, every morning I have a mixture of English breakfast tea and Earl Grey together because I find Earl Grey a bit flowery on its own.
Yeah.
But if you mix it, tell him to have a go. It's lovely.
Okay.
A teaspoon of Earl Grey, a teaspoon if it's real leaf tea of English Brett or tea bag. And it's a lovely mix.
Yeah. So my favourite is Yorkshire tea, of course.
Oh, put hairs on your chest.
I call that the crystal meth of teas.
It is. Anyway, can I just, number one, congratulate you on this new album? It's fabulous.
Oh, thank you so much.
Unfollow the Rules. It's absolutely... I mean, I've been lucky, everybody, because I got a preview copy of it. So I've been playing it all week, and it's haunting me, actually.
Yeah, well, these are haunting times, and
certainly are.
You know, and I was as I was saying earlier when we first got on. I mean, it was supposed to come out in April, but now it's coming out in July, and I think that was a really good move, mainly because. But we were all in such shock, you know, a few months ago over what was occurring. And I don't think anybody was ready to really process anything, you know, too challenging. And I think this record now it kind of goes with the kind of ongoing malaise and worry. Wow. But in a positive way. I mean,
absolutely. And some of the tracks, you know, some of them are more uplifting than others, but I think it captures the mood very well. But what's so wonderful, I think, about your music is you don't sound, or the songs don't sound like anybody else, and that to me is a true artist. You know it's you immediately, and you don't follow what's in fashion, And that's what's so intriguing. I mean, have you always kind of just had a way you are going with your music and you just don't get moved?
Yeah. Well, I, you know, it's interesting because there are moments when I've almost wanted to, you know, create some kind of Faustian bargain where I could, in fact, you know, write what was meant to go on the radio at that time and, you know, make more money and be, you know, on top of the charts and stuff. But whenever it comes down to the wire and I write a song or I'm in the studio, there's a strange kind of direction that just always takes hold, and it's this, you know, Rufus style that I don't know where it came from or how it was created, but it just totally takes control, and I end up, you know, with this product that is very incredibly unique, for better or for worse. I think the main gist of why that is that you know, I grew up in an incredibly musical family, you know, with my dad Loudon, mm-hmm. and my mom Kate McGarrigle, and they were always, I don't know, they were incredible. They were really influenced by a wide variety of music, and so I was, I don't know, I was always introduced to incredibly you know, deep stuff from a very, very early age. And then on top of that, I got into opera at 13. Which was kind of my own thing, and that, you know, further complicated things. So, yeah.
Yeah, because actually, well, certainly in this album, there are lots of kind of, like, you can hear the opera kind of influence. I love, actually, because I was trying to come up with, well, what is it? It's not pop, and it's not rock, and it's not classical. It's kind of, there's a nod to musical theatre that I can hear.
Yes, yes, definitely.
And I love your story. I watched your documentary about when you went to see Annie.
Yeah.
When you were a little boy.
Yeah, yeah.
And you fell madly in love with it and drove your mum mad because you wanted to play Annie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, is that true?
I wanted to be Annie. I wanted to be Annie, and my mother plainly told me that in fact that was possible because there were certain productions that cast, you know, prepubescent boys and you know, in somewhere in, you know, Saskatchewan or something, and which was a complete lie, you know.
That's
so
brilliant.
So for about 2 years I really thought I was going to be in a production of Annie at some point
and wear that red wig.
And so it was interesting. It was an interesting strategy.
Presumably the music had quite an influence on you if you fell in love with it so much.
No, the music was incredibly influential. And to this day, you know, I my daughter loves Annie now.
Of course.
And so I got to revisit the score and there's just so many great songs in that musical.
Yeah. But I love now that you've actually given a name to your music, Rufus Style, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
I think that's what we should call it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I've been trying. I mean, I really, for years, even when my first album came out, I was always a kind of anomaly, and I think initially it was difficult to deal with because, you know, in terms of marketing and radio, you know, nobody could ever kind of quite figure out what to do. But I think for the long run, it's really paid off. Because,
oh, absolutely. Well, also, it means you're completely true to yourself.
Yes.
You're not trying to follow a fashion or do a disco or do a, you know, rock. It's not about that. And you've got such a huge fan following who love and adore you.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. No, I have a healthy fan following. They're very loyal. And they kind of come with me on all of my shenanigans musically, and I'm fortunate to not be alone in my insanity.
So you were born in New York, right? But you grew up in Montreal?
Yeah, Montreal. Yeah, I was born in upstate New York, and
whereabouts?
In Rhinebeck.
Oh, I know. Yeah,
yeah,
it's beautiful.
Right,
it's gorgeous up there.
Yeah, and I ended up actually going back to that area for boarding school when I was a teenager, to Millbrook, which is close.
I know it well, actually. I do. We've got friends who live in Millbrook.
Yeah, yeah. So I was in that area for about 4 years for high school, and And then I went back to Canada for university. I went to McGill. So it's it's always been this fair. My early life was ferried between New York and Montreal because my dad stayed in New York after my parents divorced.
Because your dad's American, right?
Dad's American.
And I know your mom because I'm a huge fan of the McGarrigles.
Oh, wonderful.
Go way back. And I have to tell you something really funny.
Okay.
You're going to laugh.
I'd love
actually
to hear it.
But when I did an album. Because I sing a little
bit as well, and I've
done Broadway and things.
Yes.
But I did an album in 1976, 77, and I was so obsessed with the McGarrigles,
wow,
and I had the albums. And I recorded My Town.
Oh, really? Oh, wonderful.
Oh, gosh. You can probably get an old... The album was Please Get My Name Right. You can probably get an old one from, you know, you go online and you can pay £1 for it or something.
Yeah. Oh, great.
But it's nice recording, actually. I'm proud of that. But I was so obsessed with them, with the McGarrigles and Joni Mitchell, who I'd love to talk to you about in a minute. But I just thought that was the most gorgeous song. And I loved their close harmonies. And so you must have grown up with all that going on.
Yeah. I mean, my mother and aunt were... What they did, which was interesting, is that they, you know, they had quite a bit of success initially when they went to California and to make their first two records. And they were really slated... at one point to be, you know, really pushed by Warner Brothers and made into these, you know, I wouldn't say celebrities necessarily, but made into something. Mm-hmm. And they categorically refused to go there and because, you know, they had small children at the time and they were like, no, we'd rather, you know, hang out at home with our kids. And subsequently, you know, my mother moved back to Canada and really focused on bringing up my sister and I mean they still made albums
I mean, as I say, I'm it, well, it reached me in England. This is in the mid 70s.
Yeah, and they continued on you know really up until until the 90s. And but needless to say, they really made a conscious decision to focus on bringing up their kids, which, you know, certainly my sister and I benefited from,
of course.
But also there was a little bit of pent-up frustration, especially for my mother, because she was quite ambitious, my mom. And I think a lot of her dream of succeeding then kind of transferred into, you know, myself and my sister. And she was able to kind of continue her ambitions through work.
Through you.
Yeah, through us. I mean, though she wrote some of her greatest songs, you know. Even up until she passed away.
I'm so sorry about that.
Yeah,
no, my condolences. But you know, obviously her musical legacy has come out through you and your sister, which is lovely.
Yeah.
And did your mum teach you to play piano, or did
I always grew up with her playing around me, and so I gravitated towards that instrument. But then I started taking, you know, lessons with nuns and and so forth, getting it all whacked out of me.
Was it a strict boarding school?
No. I mean, this is before I went to boarding school. I was in Canada. And they still had, you know, I went to Catholic school.
You
know, it was like public school, or I don't know how you say that. I went to public school later in upstate New York.
Yeah.
But that was all nuns who taught me early on.
And they were strict.
They were just very, you know, I mean, one of the best stories that I remember having. Or fun that my mother liked to tell is that we went to visit a nun for piano lessons, and the nun said, "Oh, you know, your son has a lot of talent." And then my mother jokingly said, "Well, maybe one day he'll play Carnegie Hall," and the nun went, "Where's that?"
That's hysterical.
Yeah, so
that is truly hysterical. Oh my goodness!
It was an interesting place to grow up.
And I also read somewhere that you came, because my other obsession in those early days was Joni Mitchell.
Yes.
And I think I knew every lyric of every song ever written. I was completely obsessed with her. And I read that you kind of didn't come to her till much later because your mum didn't really like you to play her in the
My mom was somewhat conflicted about Joni Mitchell. And I think she had one good reason and one bad reason. I mean, meaning that, like, the good reason and one that I respect with her was that she was from a really arch kind of a very intense folk music scene.
Yeah.
You know, they were total purists. And in fact, I think they would come to London, you know, and hang out with like Peggy Seeger and you know, Pete Seeger. And they were into like field recording. So, you know, so Joni Mitchell for them was somewhat of an abomination. And, you know, and in their defense, I adore Joni Mitchell. I think there's, you know, a slew of people who thought after her that thought they were Joni Mitchell too, who, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, who could have been, you know. Sidetracked. Anyways, but so that was her kind of philosophy. But then on the other hand, I think she was very jealous of her success and her, you know, and the fact that she did stay and really make it in the mainstream. So it was a double-edged sword.
I'd say a double-edged sword, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But you finally did come round to Joni Mitchell and met her, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Well, what happened is that my husband, Jorn, he was, for a few years, he ran this festival in Toronto called the Luminato Festival, and a really wonderful establishment. Anyways, and it was coming round, and every year they would do a big show honoring a Canadian musician, and the year he was there, it was Joni's 70th birthday.
Oh,
and
how lovely.
That year, and she hadn't been on stage for at least 10 years. And they said, oh, you know, you should try to do a tribute to her. And he had never heard of her because he was from Germany, and they didn't really know her there. So he then, you know, discovered her music and subsequently became a rabid fan, like a real,
like me. If you like Joni Mitchell, you don't just like her. You're obsessed.
He went into the deep end, and I followed him, and I adore her music too. But he really is one of her disciples, and subsequently, you know, we did get to her to come and perform at her 70th birthday in Toronto, and it was a big deal because she hadn't been on stage
for over 10 years. Oh God, so. I wish I'd have seen that.
Yeah, no.
I became so obsessed with her. My daughter, who is 40, she grew up with me playing Joni Mitchell in the car, you know, because it was 70s. She was born in 78, so in the 80s. So she grew up loving Joni Mitchell, so much so that when she had her little girl, who's now 5, they called her Joni.
Oh, beautiful.
After Joni Mitchell.
Have you met Joni yet?
I have a long time ago. Yeah. We've got mutual friends. Do you know Peter Asher?
Yeah, I love Peter. I just saw Peter the other day.
Oh, did you?
Yeah,
oh.
No, I went down to his place in Malibu.
In Malibu. Well, you know Wendy then?
Yeah, Wendy. Yeah, no.
Wendy's one of my oldest, closest friends. Yeah. I love her to bits.
They're amazing. They're fabulous. And I love that. They have such a great art collection. I love their art.
Oh, yeah. That's Wendy, really.
Yeah.
I mean, Peter buys as well, but Wendy's.
But they have a nice, it seems like what they buy, they really love.
Oh, they do.
You know?
But she's very, very bright about art, especially because I'm not very good about modern art, but she seems to find things. She's very clever lady, and I love her to bits. She's also got a big heart.
Fabulous.
But that's anyway, so I met Joni because when I was staying in Malibu with them one summer, probably about 10 years ago. Joni came for lunch. And it was like, I was like, oh my goodness. You know, it's very weird when you meet somebody that you've loved and adored for so many years. And you think, oh, am I going to make a fool of myself? But actually, we got on really well. She was absolutely lovely.
She's doing well now. I mean, she's after her
accident. She wasn't very well for a while, was she?
But Wendy
I know she did. Wendy keeps me in touch that she's getting better, which is... Well, if you see her again, just tell her I love her.
I will.
And I send her a big kiss.
Yeah, Nobody's seeing anybody these days in that respect.
Oh, I know. How are you coping with it all?
You know, it's wildly depressing in terms of what's going on California. I mean, we tried so hard, and it didn't seem to, you know, work out for us how we wanted it to. But, you know, onwards.
Have they brought the lockdown back in California then?
They might, yeah, they might. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that's going to happen all over because, you know, once... It's very difficult because they have to lift the restrictions because of the economics. They're doing it in England now.
Right.
But you get spikes in, you know, we've had one city that's locked down again. And, I don't know.
I want to be able to come to England soon. I miss Europe a lot. The travel thing is really depressing. But you know, look, we have our health and that's what's important.
You're in California, correct?
Yeah, I'm in Laurel Canyon. Yeah.
Oh, Laurel Canyon.
Yes. Yes. No, it's beautiful. Yeah.
Is it hot and sunny at the moment? Make us all jealous.
No, it's hot and sunny. It's hot and sunny, and you know, I'm well. I love it. I mean, I was getting nervous about the fire thing. You know, of course.
Oh yeah, that's true.
We're approaching that era. But it's been beautiful, and this has been a great place to be during the quarantine, and as opposed to, you know, New York, where a lot of my friends and family are. So I feel fortunate to be here.
Yeah, because I think New York got quite badly hit, didn't it?
Really pummeled, yeah. But I don't know, LA might get pummeled now too. So we'll see.
Yeah, but you know, it's a world problem. That's the trouble. And
I mean, I think what's interesting about it here now is that in terms of, you know, being an election year, mm-hmm. a big one, you know, arguably the biggest in history, especially at least in the United States, and then also with the Black Lives Matter protests, which are totally reforming a lot of people's perception of the way this country is, and then with the pandemic, it's just a very dramatic.
Well, I think it's spreading beyond America as well. The Black Lives Matter, which is, you know, and what's wonderful is so many young voices are coming in, and you know, from all races, and saying this is not right.
Yeah,
and,
no. It's an amazing time, and
it is an amazing time.
Without, like all true revolutionary periods, it's very intense and very kind of you know, wild. So I'm happy to be here though I just for me it's boiling down to the election right now in the United States and getting Donald mm-hmm. Trump out of office
and thousands, millions, I think.
and really winning and especially turning the Senate Democratic because it is.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for craveable, hand-battered, cooked-to-order chicken fingers.
Chicken up.
Crispy, crinkle-cut fries.
Hot potato coming through.
Buttery Texas toast.
Toast walking.
And secret Cane's sauce.
Topping off now.
Turbocharge your chicken fingers and get them even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app.
Go, go, go!
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
I don't know. It's just it's going to be.
It's such a complicated. Yes. I mean, I don't actually understand the complete American system because I mean, people would say that actually the last election, Hillary got more votes per person.
Yeah.
But Trump still got in because of where the votes
were. The Electoral College.
That's where I kind of check out.
Yeah, no, I guess there's something, and I don't understand it completely myself, but there's a system in place that doesn't want to, you know, that wants to give, you know, as big a voice to, you know, rural areas that don't have as big of a population as, you know, urban areas or states that have bigger populations, which, I mean, there's arguably like an argument for that, but it's been so manipulated to just serve the Republican Party, so it just doesn't.
Well, it'd be
really
intriguing to watch.
Oh yeah, yeah.
No, do you think he'll wear a mask though?
at the convention, I don't think he's going to wear a mask. I don't think so.
He should.
But I am. I have to say, I'm quite excited about Biden, which is good. I mean,
good. Yeah, I don't really know much about him.
Yeah, I mean, he's sort of the. I've met him a couple of times. In fact, I did a benefit for him recently, and he has. What's lovely about him, which I don't think can be under kind of valued at this time, is he's compassionate. I mean, because of, you know, he had two. Or three terrible tragedies that occurred in his life, you know, with his, because his first wife and child were killed in a car accident.
That's right.
When he was very young, and then his son died of cancer not so long ago. So I think he has this, I don't know, emotional compass, which is so devoid at the moment with in terms of Trump and even the Republican Party. I mean, they're just so. They're so either angry or numb. So we just need a little love right now.
Yeah, you certainly do. I've been doing a lot of cooking and knitting and sewing. I love that. Have you learned any new things?
One of the big aspects that I've been able to really investigate in my life that for a long time was sort of on the sideline was my drawing.
Well, your drawing is amazing. That's the other I was going to say on the documentary that came with the album. Yeah. Those drawings, I thinking, I wonder who did those drawings, and then you say, yeah. I illustrated.
Yeah. No, well, it was always something. You know, I went to art school briefly in Montreal after music school. After I failed out of music school, I failed out of art school. but I maintain the, you know, just the doodling and the dabbling, you know, in that arena for many years, as kind of a fun little side project. But for this album, and because of COVID and just these wide, amounts of time that were given to me, I was allowed to really focus on that aspect of my life.
Because you said in the documentary that you loved it because it was coming out as, a vinyl,
yes,
and that you can put all the drawings in,
yeah,
so they'll all be in the album.
Yeah,
that's lovely.
Yeah, with that big, larger, you know, format, you know, you can really see the illustrations properly, and it's funny. I was going to actually release the drawings as in the vinyl and maybe even sell them, you know, as merchandise, like posters and stuff.
Uh-huh.
I have been told though that I should hold off a little bit on that, and that if, you know, if I want to continue doing this work in illustration, which I do, I should really, you know, do some more and eventually, you know, really have a proper show.
So I have an exhibition
and find, and maybe do a book of them, you know. So there won't actually...
You should, because they're fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
No, because I didn't know they were yours, and I thought, I'll look at that. Maybe I'll look at when I finish the documentary, I'll look it up. And then you say, I did the drawing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what's good about, what I like about them is that they're very sincere. You know, I mean, it's something I love to do. It's influenced by really more, you know, classical illustration, things like Beardsley and...
Yeah, I'll say that, I can see the influence.
So I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel or anything, but they are, people react strongly to them, which is, I think, in the end of the day...
But I think if you are artistic, my dad was quite artistic, and he had to go out and work, but he drew at home, and he always painted all his life.
Wow.
I can do a little bit, I'm not great, but my daughter, Carly, she's really good,
wow.
and she actually studied art animation, so, I mean, and she, you know, she spent... From a tiny little girl, she always had to have a pen or a pencil, and it's just there.
Yeah.
You just have to do it.
Yeah.
And to this day, I mean, she's a mum at the moment, but she draws all the time, and she draws for the kids and things.
Yeah. And this time, I mean, I have to say, it is, especially in terms of just not having any noise, not watching any television, you know, just not really even reacting to what's happening in the world around you. Nothing quite compares to getting lost in drawing, in an illustration.
That's true, actually.
You know, you really
that with sewing, you see. I get my sewing machine out, I get my fabric, I put my music on, and the world goes away.
My mother was an amazing knitter. That was what she...
Oh, yeah.
She
well,
loved.
I knit as well for my grandchildren.
Yes.
And is it true your little girl came up with the title of Unfollow the Rules?
Yeah, that's so great.
She
announced it one day that she was unfollowing the rules, and of course, like a responsible father, I immediately left and wrote a song about it. As opposed to reprimanding her.
But it's such a great phrase,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah,
did
yeah.
she say, I'm going to unfollow, I don't want to, I'm going
yeah,
to unfollow
said,
the rules?
I am going to unfollow the rules. And and I think she was at that amazing age where they just hear a lot of phrases and expressions, and then they put them together, even though they're not necessarily meant to be, you know, and...
Right. How old is she?
She's 9 now, but she came up with this when she was about 6. So,
brilliant.
Yeah, and I think it was this thing where maybe she'd heard a lot about like unfollowing people on Facebook or Instagram.
Oh yeah.
And then there was the rules, and then she was like, "Oh, I'll just press the button, and I don't have to follow them anymore."
So you were saying a little while ago about classical music,
yeah.
your love. You've written two operas,
two
correct?
Operas, yeah. Prima Donna
wow.
and Hadrian. Actually, this is a painting here that ended up being the cover of my first opera for Deutsche Grammophon. We used that. That's the cover of it. So yeah, no, I'm a big opera buff.
Was that scary, suddenly thinking I'm going to write an opera, or did
yeah,
it just
yeah.
kind of flow out of you?
Well, I mean, it was scary, and thankfully it flowed. So it was a bit of both. I think the scariest part was really not so much. I mean, yes, composing it and producing it was Herculean and difficult and also incredibly rewarding and so forth. But I think it was when I was, let's just say there was a percentage of the critics who loved it. There was another percentage of the critics who I kind of more sided with, who had very constructive, things to say, and were, more intrigued, but, not necessarily, bowled over. And then there was like this one section who were just so savage and
aren't
so
they horrible
and so mean and so kind of like bitter. Oh. And that was, I had never come into contact with that sort of intensity.
Viciousness. That's just, but a lot of it is jealousy. I hate to tell you.
Yeah.
What can they do? Can they write beautiful songs your voice is unbelievable. They're probably, they're just jealous, and also certainly in this country, I don't know whether it happens as much in America, but probably, if you become like too famous and too loved, they want to bring you down because it's like, let's build them up. Oh yeah, they're brilliant. Oh no, we don't.
They do that a lot in Canada. And probably because it's part of the, the Commonwealth. But America, they're less obsessed.
Yeah, they kind of like success more in America, I think.
But the thing in America is that if you're not like monetarily successful, then they bring you down.
That's interesting.
That's their, if you don't make a lot of money, you're kind of considered a loser, which is equally as gross.
But I've been in the business since over 50 years doing various things, and I started as a model, and in this country, if you're a model, you're thick and stupid and can't do anything else. So I got all the flack for that, and you think, oh well, screw you, I'm gonna have a go anyway. And then I was lucky because I met amazing people who gave me the chart. I met Ken Russell, the film director, who put me in my first film that was a musical. And then I met Tommy Chu. Do you know Tommy?
I know Tommy. Yeah, I mean, I've never...
We did a big show on Broadway together. No. And so
Penelope Tree?
Oh yes.
Yes, yeah.
One of my first bookings in Paris for American Vogue for the French collections was with Penelope.
Wow.
I mean, I think I was 17 or 18, and she's a year younger than me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because we just spent the whole time in absolute hysterics. Yeah. It was with Richard Avedon, the great photographer, who was divine. And I was so tiny, because I'm not, you know, for modelling, I was minute. I'm only 5'6".
Wow.
So all these clothes would arrive from the collections that were made for girls who have 6'4".
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd put them on and I'd be drowned and we'd just be in hysterics.
Because actually having met you now, because Penelope came to one of my shows once, and then also I was quite good friends at one point with Verushka. So it was sort of that whole era.
I was obsessed with Verushka. And when funny because I just thought she was the most beautiful creature on earth. I'd never met her. And then in 1983, I did my one and only on Broadway with Tommy. It was a big Gershwin musical. And the guy who used to do my hair when I was modelling for American Vogue, a lovely man who's no longer with us, Ara Gallant, he came to the show and I didn't know. There was a knock on my dressing room door because he knew I was obsessed with Verushka all those years before. And I opened the door and there was Ara and he'd brought Verushka to the show. Oh, my God. And then we went out to dinner. It was wonderful. She was divine, absolutely divine.
Such a character and with her cats.
Yeah, extraordinary woman. So you also, didn't you live in New York? Didn't you live at the Chelsea Hotel?
I lived in the Chelsea Hotel for about a year.
Wow, what was that like?
Yeah, no, it was amazing. I mean, it was... What happened to me in New York is kind of, it's a funny story because I was born in New York State and I would go all the time to visit my dad and spend certain holidays there in the summer and stuff out on Long Island. Anyways, but initially I went, after I dropped out of university, I went to try to make it in New York and as a singer-songwriter, failed miserably. What I was doing did not correspond at all with the kind of grunge, kind of heroin chic thing at the time going on downtown. I was this sort of dandy, piano playing, opera loving gay boy, and it just didn't fit well with downtown New York. So I kind of retreated with my tail between my legs, but then was signed by a company, by DreamWorks Records in L.A., and went out there and did very well in California for a few years, made my first record. And then I went back to New York, you know, with a deal and an album. And of course, all the, you know, poo-pooers and naysayers immediately wanted to be friends with me.
Of course.
And, you know, I was let into all the clubs and got all the gigs and promptly, you know, rented a room at the Chelsea Hotel.
Like you do.
You know, changed my wardrobe and became this like very New York thing and had a, you know, and was there for a good 15 years. But it was funny. I kind of had to reconquer New York.
It's like if I couldn't live in London, I think I'd probably live in New York.
I will say I love New York, and we keep an apartment there, a little tiny studio, and I'll always, you know, prize that city in a lot of ways. But it isn't the same as it used to be in the 90s for me. And I think, I guess the city changes regardless. But it's a little, I don't know.
You do have to get out, don't you? I mean, I was, the longest I've lived in New York was when I was doing the Broadway show and I was there for 2 years because I had to be, you know, I was doing a show. You can't commute. And I must say at the end of it, it was like, I got to get out.
But it's also like, I mean, when I was talking to, about my mother's boyfriend, Pat, who was from England, who was, you know, lived in London. He lives in France now, but I said to him, like, oh, do you ever have the desire to go back to London and live in London? He's like, Rufus, London is not the same city as when I was living there.
That's
it's
true.
Like a whole other city. And I feel like New York in a lot of ways is the same.
Yeah.
It's not the same city.
I don't know how well you write a lot about London. That's what I want to
know. Yeah, no, I love, yeah.
There's that lovely, you talk about Belsize Park.
Yes, and Paddington Green.
Yeah. So have you spent quite a lot of time? Why Belsize Park? Did you hang out there?
I have spent quite a bit of time in London. And my dad, Loudon Wainwright, he lived in England for a good 10 years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he lived in West Hampstead.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So I would go there in the 80s and visit him.
Oh, because Belsize Park's just down the road.
Yeah, it's down the street. But the person I know best in Belsize Park is Helena Bonham Carter.
Oh, yeah, because she's in that... Yeah. I was going to ask you about that wonderful video with her.
She's divine
in that.
Yeah.
Isn't she?
She has an amazing property in Belsize Park. She has like these,
yeah, I know she does.
Famous,
but she's also the most
artist.
I love her. She's so gorgeous and beautiful and talented and eccentric and I don't know her well, but we
has she been on your show? Yeah, you haven't had tea with her yet.
No, I haven't actually. I should. That's a very good idea. I'm going to tell her that you suggested it.
Yes. You must. And she's game.
Also, because, you know, it's not, I like to try and talk to people who will have a giggle and, you know,
And
her career has been amazing. She's a very talented young lady.
Incredible.
The NBA playoffs are back. And on FanDuel, new customers can bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets guaranteed. Back in the day, news like this, your crew would have been writing each other letters.
Dearest Benjamin, wonderful news from the East. The spread has been covered.
Or maybe you'd use your phone to actually call someone.
Man, you see that dunk? Man, I saw that dunk.
But these days, it's all about the group chat.
I love that high-fiving kitten emoji.
No matter how you tell them, let your crew know that all new FanDuel customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets guaranteed. Ooh, Morse code. Classic. FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
So when you went in to do this album, Unfollow the Rules, which came out on July the 10th, right, in England?
Yes, July the 10th, yes.
Did you, because you talked a lot about your producer that you said kind of let you run, but kind of you said just do one take. Is that true?
Amazing. Mitchell from... Well, he was in a band called Crowded House.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, yeah.
I loved Crowd. I didn't put that together.
Yeah, he was in that band.
Oh,
and he also
brilliant.
Produced a lot of Randy Newman records. He produced a lot of... He was married to Suzanne Vega
for
years. And he worked with her. So he's done a lot. And what was great is that he was very intent on not clouding the song, you know, and have it be this... immediate, rather quick effect where, you know, if it worked, then let's just stay with that and move on to something else that works. And so it wasn't all done in one take necessarily, but there was no need. We would sort of find a take that we liked and then we would just use that one. And I think what was great about it is that, you know, on an artistic level, it gave it more of a sense of urgency,
mm-hmm.
more of a sense of, you know, just more of a live quality to it. But B, it was also incredibly less expensive.
Well, yeah,
than, you know,
the record industry has, you know, been very hit all over. It's not like the old days where the record companies threw millions of dollars at artists. So it's kind of finding new ways of doing things and on much more of a budget, isn't it?
Yeah. And it is. And I do, you know, look, I made my first albums were very expensive and subsequently I made no money off of record sales because I had to, you know, pay back.
You'd spent it.
Yeah. So this one, I don't know, Mitchell was really cognizant of that and he paid attention to the budget, which might sound really boring and annoying, but I actually think it makes for better music.
Well, that's interesting. Well, I have to say that I can't wait for everyone to get this album because it's really wonderful. And It's so eclectic and goes into so many kind of areas. It's like, and you know, your voice is just amazing. Amazing,
oh,
your voice.
Thank
it's
you.
So
thank
beautiful.
You.
It kind of, when you go into the high notes, I don't know, it kind of gets inside you. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, I've been working a long time on my voice, and I think partially due to my passion for opera, mm-hmm. I'm oddly following the same trajectory. Even though I'm not a classical singer, but in the classical world as an opera singer, it's really in your 40s where you blossom.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's where you. That's when you sing the big roles, you know. And you and So I think that somehow. I'm on that track more than.
Do you have singing lessons or
no,
have you had no?
No
that
I mean,
you
I
just
had them
sing
occasionally. Here and there, little coachings, but nothing. I mean, the well known story about my opera career or my non opera career as a singer is that I was at McGill in music school and I was studying composition and piano, and then I thought, well, maybe I should, you know, dabble and a little and see what the opera department is like for singing. And I went in to sing for them, and I had a kind of an odd outfit on, and to top it off, I was wearing this bizarre pair of clogs. I had this big, it was, you know, it was the 90s. I was wearing clogs and kind of punk clogs. And I sang for the professor and he said, oh, you have a wonderful voice, you know, I think you could do quite well, but mm-hmm. you know what, you got to lose the clogs.
Did he really?
Yeah, and I said, so you know what, I'm keeping the clogs, and I subsequently didn't become an opera singer because of the clogs.
That's so funny. Well, it's been absolutely delightful to meet you, even virtually, and hopefully we can meet properly one day.
No, definitely.
With a lot of our mutual friends.
Yes, I know. We have to really sit down and map that out, because it would be great. It would be great to meet you, and I can't wait to get back to London. And
we'll do it. And good luck with Unfollow the Rules. Do you want to tell people where they can?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's now out. July 10th, it came out, and. I highly recommend getting the vinyl, just because we worked a lot on the packaging. But you can, of course, get it on CD. You can, you know, download. You can stream it. However, it's all the major outlets. And you know, just to know one little thing about it, which is good, is that unlike any other record I've ever made with a major label, I have a licensing deal with BMG. So I actually make a lot more money on this record.
Oh, good.
So just to let the public know.
Everyone
yeah,
buy
if you buy it,
please.
I'm actually, it's coming, a lot of the money is coming to me directly as opposed to the record company.
Right, that's good.
So buy it, please.
My favorite track at the moment, it'll change, yeah. But my favorite track, there's a song on it called Only the People Who Love.
Oh, yeah, a lot of people.
I love it. Yeah. It's so gorgeous. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And stay well.
Oh, you too.
Stay
you too.
Safe.
Yes.
And hopefully we'll meet.
Let's get together.
In the future.
Yes.
When we can all travel a little
yes.
bit.
That's wonderful. Bye-bye.
Oh, that was so lovely talking to Rufus. And if you want to listen to the album, it's called Unfollow the Rules, and it's out now. And it's fabulous. If you've enjoyed listening to Tea with Twiggy, please take a moment to give us a lovely 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people to find the show. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to this podcast so you auto-magically get the next episodes for free. And do tell all your friends and family about it too. If you want to connect with me, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Twiggy, or you can find me on Instagram at Twiggy Lawson. My thanks go to all the people that have helped this podcast happen. Many thanks to James Carroll and all the team at North Bank Talent Management. Thanks to all the team at Stripped Media, including Ben Williams, who edits the show, my producer Kobe Omanaka, and executive producers Tom Wally and Dave Corkery. The music you can hear now is my version of Waterloo Sunset by The Kinks. If you'd like to hear the whole song, you can find it and all the other songs I've recorded on iTunes and Spotify. So check it out. I look forward to you joining me for my next episode. So see you then. Bye.